Welcome back to another episode of Love Handles, a particularly boozy romp through George Friedrich Handel's musical dramas. That's not the tagline, but it's pretty close. This week, my good friend Joshua Druckenmiller and I get to sit down and deep dive into Handel's last known work, Jephthah. I hope everyone is staying safe and doing what they can to help others during this pandemic, and as a reminder, Black Lives Matter. Enjoy this conversation. Wait, ready for some wine ASMR?
Ooh.
That was nice. I like
that. It was relaxing. I wish that that was like that, the way I just felt right there. I wish that's the way I felt when my dog was like licking himself in the middle of the night.
I hate it.
Like, wow, that's relaxing. No, it's just like, I sit there and I feel all of the muscles in my back tense up. Like, stop, stop. I've yelled at him before. I've gotten up and like thrown stuff at him. Like, you can clean yourself tomorrow. Like,
he's such a good boy.
He's the best.
I know. Joshua Druckenmiller, you are a fellow bartender.
Yeah.
You're a dodgeballer.
Uh-huh.
You're a recent cabaret star. Well, you did some cabaret stuff, and I was like, that's close enough. You're a tenor. And you've played Mercury more times than any person I've ever met in my life. I feel like you've played Mercury a lot.
That was pretty much my MO for, I think it was three operas, three different programs. I was Mercury in every single one of them. Actually, and the one I wasn't even Mercury full time. I was Mercury for literally two measures. Like, I was someone else for the rest of the opera.
He's gotta be Mercury for two measures. We gotta make it happen. But yeah. We met, oh God, how many years ago?
It was 2014, summer 2014.
Yeah, we were at the Queen's College Baroque Opera Workshop.
Wait, so I assume we started recording at this point, right?
Oh, yeah. I like to not tell people when it's happening. Yeah, so can you give me... Those are all accurate things, I think. I only said cabaret star because you did that one queer cabaret thing that one time.
Oh, yeah, online. That's right. Yeah.
And you're a star, baby. Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Handel? Like, what is your relationship with him?
Okay, so Handel and I, we're getting there.
Okay. So,
well, for me before, so you know all the intricacies of my vocal journey, and I struggled a lot with having some body oddy oddy in my sound. So a lot of Handel didn't really work for me because it's like he wrote everything for John Beard, who was heroic. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He was all, and all of his tenors are like war heroes and fathers, which is totally my aesthetic, but... But so just recently I felt like my voice fit Handel. Mm-hmm. Whereas before I felt like I was doing Handel because everyone made me do it in my audition package.
Right.
So we're getting there. I love the music, but I feel like I'm connecting with it a little more now.
Now that you're a war hero and a father. Okay, so we're here today to talk about the behemoth of a oratorio, that is Jephthah, pick one, I don't care.
Honestly, for a while, I don't know what I was thinking, but I was pronouncing it Jephthah.
He said... They said, do you love this oratorio? And you said, yep, the.
I don't know. He used to be German.
You truly. Yeah, no. And this is gonna be the first episode where I talk about something that I literally had no idea about before seeing it for the first time, like for this. So that'll be a ride.
Oh yes, I literally finished the opera 45 minutes ago.
Great.
So
So
we're
it's fresh. It's so fresh. We love to hear it. Okay, so because it is so fresh, do you think you can surmise this plot in three sentences?
Okay. So Jephthah is asked to lead the Israelites into battle against the Ammonites. One sentence. And he promises that if he succeeds in battle, he will sacrifice the first living thing that he sees upon returning home to God, and that turns out to be his daughter. That was a very long second
I
sentence.
was like, okay,
That was
two-ish.
very intentional. And in the end, God says, "Nope."
You made up for it with the last one.
Comma, and she lives.
Yeah. Which, I mean, we should kind of touch on the fact that this is a story from the Old Testament, from the book of Judges. And so the librettist actually changed the plot from the original Old Testament story. So originally, his daughter, is given as a sacrifice to God because that was the deal that he made. But in this version, the librettist chose to have an angel intervene and say, "Now hang on a second. We gotta save the daughter."
Well, and it's interesting, as I was reading up about this, and I didn't crack open my New International Version, but when I was reading about the Bible story, it said that it's not actually clear, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not actually clear if he sacrifices her, as in kills her, or if he just gives her up as an eternal virgin, which back then meant that his bloodline was ending, which was a sacrifice in itself. Like, it was really looked down upon. So it's not actually clear if he actually kills her or not.
Yes. Which I think is it's interesting to me only because so Morrill, who was the librettist, was also a reverend, which I thought that was it's interesting to have a librettist come from such a religious point of view and to like maybe imbue the story with like his opinions as someone who is part of the faith. But
Wow, catering Bible stories to your own opinion doesn't happen nowadays.
listen,
Oop.
we would never. You're correct though. Oh. Because this is a podcast and not a video medium, he is pouring Hendrix into his glass.
When I was feeling very fancy and made myself an aviation earlier, but all of that is downstairs. And James is right here in front of me. So my travel
through the
bottle of
magic of
Hendrix will do.
right, absolutely. So yeah, super interesting with a different ending. And this is also his last the last thing that he wrote, supposedly. So some people think, because he Handel, I mean, not Morrill. But yeah, he was going blind. This is like the last this is the last that we see of him.
But
We said, "Oh, goodbye, Handel." This is it, which I think is great because I do think that this oratorio is a very streamlined version of what he normally does.
Yes, I noticed that as I was going through it, that, like, I feel like, and maybe it's just a result of our modern sensitivity, but we have to kind of interpret and figure out Handel and how to receive it as expressive sometimes. Mm-hmm. And this one, even in the da capo aria format, like, it felt, I was engaged with it,
mm-hmm.
pretty musically. We'll get to the production in a second, but like, musically, I didn't feel like it was stagnant or.
Yeah, like, he keeps it pumping.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, we're not stopping for nobody.
Bop after bop after bop.
Truly, though. So we both watched the same production, which is Ivar Bolton conducting the Freiburger Baroque Orchestra. And it's got Topi Leitipu as Jephtha. Oh my gosh. And we got...
okay, so can we just decide for the rest of the recording that we're sure. going to pronounce it differently every time we say it?
Oh, yeah. I love okay. that. Great.
That'll solve all our problems.
This is also one of the first episodes in a while where I am more buzzed than I was expecting to be. So this is fun. Carolyn Sampson is Iphis. We got Anne Hollenberg as Storge.
Let's do the same with this.
I love it. It won't be confusing for anybody.
But also, can I just throw in there that we stan Anne Hollenberg.
We love her.
That to me was the most exciting name in the production. Keep going.
Oh, okay. Not Christophe Dumeau as Hammer. Hamor.
I think they pronounced it Hamor in the production. Right.
We got Daddy Dumeau as Hamor. and Andrew Foster Williams as Zebul. Okay, but wait, speaking of discrepancies of things in like the Bible versus like this, another interesting fun fact I came about with was mm-hmm. The librettist condensed Jephtha's brothers into one character and then added two characters, which is Hammer, which is going to be the love interest of his daughter, and then the wife, what is her name? Storge.
I don't think they never say her name in the music, do they?
Yeah, I literally read a review from the Hollywood Bowl earlier today where they called her Mrs. Jephtha. It made me laugh. It made me laugh very, very hard. I was like, yes, this is the character, Mrs. Jephtha. Jephtha.
Which I don't love just because I don't like the concept of her only being an extension of Jephtha.
Right. But still has some of the best music.
Yes, very much so.
Still given some of the best music, in my humble opinion. Because mm-hmm. she was so... Honestly, I think the reason she was added was because she is the mezzo who it was originally written for. Was so loved by Handel. She was given, mm-hmm. like, some of the best roles. Like, she was... oh my gosh. I was just reading this earlier today, and I was like, oh, it's Katerina... Golly.
Mm-hmm.
And she got to do things like Solomon in Solomon. She got to do Alexander Ballas as Alexander. And then she was also Joachim in Susanna, which same. Which also same. Yeah, so she like Handel is just like, here, take these roles, gal.
Well, and fun. Obviously, you've got to have some love interest if you're going to keep the audience's attention. And we also needed a female character with a little more variety.
We needed someone with a little more chutzpah. I mean, not that Iphis is like not... that interest. She's not that interesting. I'm so sorry. She's got great music.
I didn't know if we were going to get into this now or when we started talking about like the chronological events, but she was, and again, is it Ephus or Iphis?
I don't know anymore.
Iphis is, to me, the least interesting character in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because all of her, like, all of her text, and I was thinking, is this inherent or is this, like, a result of the production? But all of her text is, everything is great. Oh, I also might have to die. Everything is great. Oh, but don't touch me yet. Everything is great. But, like, she has no... Her character doesn't go anywhere. Even when she's giving herself up for sacrifice, she's still like, but it's for the good of the world.
We said on you stay. Yeah. Okay, so to clarify about what was kind of happening in this production that we watched, which I do highly recommend because I thought it was really smartly done. Correct me if you think differently, but the way that they decided to stage this was through a lot of pantomime, but specifically as people in 1750. It was pantomimed through, like, the... I had to look up what was going on in the 1750. Oh, it was because... This is interesting. Sorry, my brain just went into, like, 8 different places. At the time, in 1750, which they did a lot of, like, agricultural pantomime throughout this production, but I was reading that the agricultural output in England was at least twice that of any other European country, and it did that until 100 years later. But I was like, oh, okay, cool. So obviously we're talking about, like, strong agricultural things, people going to war because they did use muskets in this production, as opposed to going all the way back and doing things in, like, you know, doing things with Israel and setting it in, like, the actual biblical story. And then they, instead of having the choir and the choruses interact with everyone, they were, it does take place in the Book of Judges, and everyone was in a jury as the chorus. They were in their little jury pews.
See, and you know, I didn't even clock that, because to me, they were just, like, some of the chorus text is looking at the story from a third person. So I was like, are they just not a part of the drama?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know if they were just separated in that way, but that would explain why most of the time they were singing with no facial expression.
They were a very staunch group of singers, and I kind of appreciated it because everyone was so expressive on the lower part of the stage where all the action was mm-hmm. taking place.
And it also made for a very, very good contrast later on in the production, which we'll get to, when the chorus actually got involved.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we can get into that if you want. If you want to skip ahead to that, I don't mind that.
Do we really want to skip into my favorite part of the production now?
Is it also your... yeah, why don't we? Why don't we scoot our way... I had, oh wait, hang on one second. I did want to say one more other fun fact about England in 1750. only because I thought, okay, this was another quote that I found specifically about England in the mid-1700s. And us talking about, like, how this is, like, it's a very restrained handle oratorio, because you think of things like Hercules and you think of things like Susanna, where things are, like, they go balls to the wall a lot. And this was a particularly, like, restrained end-of-life handle. But I thought it was interesting because they said, restraint in the expression of passion that had become more of a mark of a gentleman, and good manners had become more valued as a barrier against conflict. That was just, like, a quote that I read from a little history textbook. And I was like, oh. Literally, restraint being used to describe this as, like, a streamlined version of, like, what Handel normally does. I was like, okay. We love a historical context with a dramatic context. It, like, explains why he is, I find him to be very restrained in his orchestration of this. personally.
Yes, yes. Ooh, sorry, got a little froggy. But
you are a tenor.
Oh, bitch. But that also, I think that they worked that into the dramatization of it as well, which I think worked in some spots, and I don't think it worked in other spots.
Yeah.
But one spot where I do think it worked,
okay,
where we will now jump, is, and no, this is not my obsession with the aria that we'll get to later, but when Iphis is singing Welcome as the Cheerful Light, which is when it's Act Two and Jeff has just come back victorious and he's waiting to see the first living thing to come out of his home that he's going to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter comes out and sings this beautiful, happy, oh, everything is great and you've won the war and there's peace in Israel now. And to me, this was the most powerful moment in this production because it zooms in on Topi's face. I'm going to say Topi because I don't know where the accent is in his last name. But you just see his eyes bug out of his face. And it's this moment where, like, it's this, there's nothing in the music that hints at pain at this point, but you just see him deteriorate.
Mm.
And to me, that was the most, like, he didn't lash out. He just slowly kind of crumpled to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, the chorus comes into action and hits him with flowers. Like, they're throwing flowers off the balcony, and with everyone that hits him, he kind of, like, winces in pain. And to me, that was, like, that's what I wanted at the climax of this production.
Mm-hmm.
It happened a little early, but that's the moment where I almost cried watching this, was just seeing him realize, like, I have to kill my daughter.
He's like, well, shucks, I gotta kill my daughter.
And that's, I think, the restraint after this moment.
Yeah.
In this production kind of takes away from the pain that we should be feeling. But in that moment, I thought it was, and especially, like I said, there was no musical cue when normally there's always something underlying.
Right, like, normally we're given a hint.
Even though she's happy, something's happening under the surface. No, she's thrilled, and we're just watching this man crumple to this really joyous music, and it hurts.
Yeah, it was super tough to watch that, and he did a great job of creating that juxtaposition. You know, I love art. Art is so good. is that?
That's just big enough to work.
I just love art, you know. Is that also is that your bop of the opera?
That is not my bop of the opera.
What is your bop?
Oh, you know what my bop is.
I don't like it when you phrase it like that.
You know my bop, baby. So my bop of the opera is 100% Waft Her Angels Through the Skies.
Wow, shocker. Now,
not a... Well, and that's... I told you would know. But obviously not a bop in the traditional sense. We're not bouncing around with coloratura.
Yeah, it's a slow jam, for sure.
But to me... And again, maybe this is just the personal, like, I will be singing this sentiment. But to me, it is one of the most moving Handel arias that I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel so strongly about this because this production did not do it justice.
Oh.
So when I hear this, and it's often done out of context, it can be so sentimental and you can really play with the tempo and draw it out. And even though, so the context of the aria is that he's giving up his daughter to heaven,
mm-hmm,
and saying, like, carry her on her journey. And it's this really, you've got this lush orchestration that's kind of imitating the breeze and the angels lifting her up. And the tenor just has all these long, long extended melismas that just go from the bottom to the top.
Right.
And the way they did it in this production, he was stoic the entire time. And I think I maybe that didn't come through, like that's the reason it didn't come through in the voice, that when he had these beautiful melismas that reached up into these really high registers, just like the vibrato took over, there was no, I felt like there wasn't a lot of shape to it, and I didn't see him hurting.
Come for him.
Like when, no, and and I love Topi Latipu so much. Like he was my first Ferrando. He like, I really love the stuff that he does, especially his Baroque music.
Yeah.
But, and I think it was a directorial choice. I don't think it was him.
Yeah. For contextual reference, I'm going to put a clip of it right here. Great. There it was. It was beautiful.
I'm moved.
I'm moved. I love art. I love art so much.
But I feel like when I sing this, I want to, you know, I have to feel that pain and that sadness. Like I think about to the listening audience, I have a beautiful little bean of a puppy named Phineas. And so as I was thinking about this aria, I thought, how would I feel if I had to kill my dog because I made a promise to God? And like, so when I sing this aria, I don't care how pious and just I'm supposed to be, like I wanna be on the verge of tears.
Yeah.
And in this production, I felt like they just turned it into a ceremony and he was like, eh, no, this is what I have to do.
Yeah.
Is that too extreme?
No, I completely agree. I also thought it was very odd that like later on, she's just kind of sitting there with a blade smiling at the audience. And it made me feel, I think that was probably a directorial choice where they're like, just sit there and smile. The audience is going to feel weird. And I was like, good, because I feel not great about this.
These biblical stories make for great dramas, but then we take it out of musical context and we're like, why was this happening?
Oh, we said, pourquoi?
Pero like why?
Yeah, it's a lot. Okay. To match your wafty angels, I'm saying my bop of this thing was the Spare Your Daughter quartet, or the Oh Fuck No duet quartet. I think that's how I have it in my notes, is the Oh Fuck No, because it's all the main characters except for the person who's actually going to die, because apparently we don't want to hear from women when they're going to get hurt.
Oop. Wow. Who fact.
I'm just saying, it's very interesting that we decided to leave the person who's going to be the most affected by the decision that a man made out of the quartet. When where's her opinion in all this?
Well, she comes in a few seconds later to say, it's fine.
Eesh. Yeah, it was just, I thought that was kind of odd, but I do enjoy the fact that we were given a quartet, which we are not often given. We are not often given ensembles in Handel. And for once, we have the mother, we have the lover, we have the father, and we have her uncle.
His brother.
Yes, so her uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, everyone's saying, oh, what, why?
Can you not?
And, yeah, and then good old Jephtha saying, oh no, this is what's going to happen. Sorry, everybody.
I made a pinky promise.
Yeah, he said, I made a deal, and now we get a deal with it. Welcome to
Shark Tank. And the really cool thing about
that is Shark Tank.
But that ensemble to me felt like, I mean, it was cool that they were all embodied characters, but to me, each of them was an angel or a devil on his, well, they were all angels on his shoulder.
Right.
Saying like, hey friend, what yeah. about this?
It's also like, for me, that was the crux of this opera, like where things officially took the turn of like, ooh, now it's gonna get spicy. Which I appreciated, and I'll put a little clippy clip of that right here. Yeah. So, in your opinion, I was trying to decide between these two questions. I had two other conversational questions that I wanted to ask, but, yeah. Who did you think was the most interesting character? Did you cover this already? I feel like you did. I feel like you pretty much...
No, I talked about who the least interesting character was.
Yes. Are you gonna go with Jep though?
No, I think inherently he could be, because mm-hmm. we start with his sort of return to glory, and then his success in battle, and then his distress at having to kill his daughter.
Yeah,
but then trying to stifle that, and then he doesn't have to. So there's he has a arc that you can really, really mess with. But Storge stood out to me. Mrs.
Jephtha. Yes. I was going to say the same thing. Great.
Yeah, because so
as a character that was not supposed to be in the story at all, she became the most interesting.
Yes. When like scenes of horror, bop bop bop.
That was my what is that called? My runner-up for best bop was her mad scene, because every mezzo deserves a good mad scene.
Yes, that's I have the same thing. I have scenes of horror bop exclamation point in my notes.
Bop. Yeah, she gets a vision, and she kind of about what she does not know that her husband has made this deal, and she gets a vision in the middle of the night. And wakes up and is just like, oh God, something feels bad. Which, we love some intuition. We love a woman with intuition.
Yes. Well, and she gets that. She gets the aria where she...
she gets that song.
She gets that pretty song. She gets that aria where she sends Jephtha off to war, but says... you know, this is what we have to do, and you'll return successful. Then she has an aria at the end where they're kind of like trading off between all of the characters having an aria or a recite to just say how happy they are that everything worked out. And she has this aria that's like all coloratura and nothing else to say, I'm a happy mother. And so she has, to me, she has the starkest contrast.
Mm-hmm. She goes through the most transitional emotions.
Which, and again, as a bystander, essentially.
Truly. Yeah, that's tough. And like, yeah, her opinions, I feel like because she is the bystander, she kind of is the most real out of all these people. She was given enough of like an emotional palette for me to be like, you are a real like fleshed out human compared to the others. Call me crazy. Okay. Would you like to, or based off of like how you've seen some of this done before, or how would you want to see this opera oratorio? I'm calling it an opera because it essentially is. I know it is not really, but you know. Mm-hmm. Would you set it this way again? In this like 1750s agricultural revolution in England?
So I definitely thought the context worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like at no point during this production did I think they just slapped this on to the opera.
Right.
So I think it made a lot of sense. There were times when I felt like the interpretive dance didn't add anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to see, the chorus made sense to me, but I think it would, like from the beginning, I kind of wish the chorus was part of the onstage ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
I
felt bad that they had to memorize the whole thing and then just stand there. Let them have their music.
Did you notice that, so at the end it's kind of a quintet, but it cycles through everybody. And honestly, thank God they cut some of the arias out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just all five main characters sharing their thoughts. It was like the divertissement that we didn't need.
my memoirs.
But, oh, where was I going with this? Sorry. Oh yeah, they had books. So the five main characters had books as if they were now singing in an oratorio. And from the camera angle, you can see the pages are blank. Did you clock that?
I did, but I thought they were supposed to be Bibles because they're all returning back to like their piety.
Oh, see, I thought that they were now singing in an oratorio.
Oh, well.
Either way, there was nothing on the page.
Do you love art? Because I love art. Art is subjective.
But anyway, I thought the setting worked. I think, yeah. Like, with some minor directorial tweaks.
The whole thing's
She's
on Twitter.
A millennial. But with some little tweaks, I think that the production actually worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little skeptical when I saw the very puritanical women's garb.
Mm.
But
it did take me a minute to really figure out where we were, especially not being a European history buff. I did have to do some light research, because at first I did think that we were in like Salem witch trials. Which I was like, mm-hmm. I would be so down for a Yiptha in the Salem witch trials.
Yiptha.
Yeah. I would be very interested to see something like that where you have a little external spookiness involved. Especially when it comes to like a religious war, I guess, or when you have like such stark differences in beliefs that we saw, like specifically them being literally in like a war of religion at the time. Something like that would just be very interesting to me. I just want a little bit more spookiness, high stakes. Give me some high stakes. Not that there weren't high stakes in this, but like, it felt a little flazé-da at moments, where I was like, I gotta have some grit.
Well, and that's, so that brings up the question, like, how much, if we're valuing restraint in this opera so much, like, this production clearly went for restraint, but do we just leave that to the music and the text?
Yeah.
So that visually and as far as the production goes, do we have something wild happening and then these characters just trying to be as expressive as possible within the restraint of the music? It's, there's a lot to work with, for sure.
I love art. Okay, and now it's my favorite question of all questions. If you could have anyone sing Handel, who would it be? Once again, for reference, I always say Dolly Parton, because she would be my Handelian queen.
So I was semi-prepared for this, because I've listened to the podcast before. I'm a big fan.
Oh my gosh.
But I kept trying to think outside the box, and the person I kept going back to is Mother Monster Lady Gaga. I would love to see her as the crazy mezzos in these operas. As Storge, as Dejanira in Hercules, like
Dejanira, Deianira.
Do you, what is it?
We Dejanira. I know, right? I was like, what are we doing? Yes, give me, I want a Lady Gaga, Joyce DiDonato mashup, please. Collab. Ooh,
yes, yes, yes.
give Battle of the Mezzos. I want them to sound their trumpets. I want them to get weird with their handle. I want that Stabat Mater.
But that's why I think I thought of Lady Gaga. Like, again, I'm thinking Scenes of Horror and Dejanira's mad scene, and like, this is everything Lady Gaga does on stage.
Right. I don't know why you're gagging. She brings it to you every time. Okay, Joshua, where can people find you?
I am on Instagram at thattinytenor. No underscores. I am small and I am a tenor. It's pretty straightforward. I'm also on Twitter on that handle, but I rarely tweet anything. I think that's, Instagram's probably the best place to find me.
We love it. Hey, and as always, people can find me at Countertenor James across all social media. Thanks for coming and doing this.
Oh, thank you. It was so much fun.
Yes. Now we're going to keep drinking.
Bye.